Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 453 for Wednesday, June 12th, 2013.
And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in questions, tips, and cool stuff found. We provide answers to the questions. We poll the community for more tips and cool stuff found. And together, the goal is for all of us, me included, to learn something new about the Mac and Apple and technology and life in general. Here at the around the Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference here in San Francisco, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in boring old Fairfield, Connecticut, this is John F. Braun.
You should come out for WWDC 1 year. You would love it.
I should.
Yeah.
So, number one, you did, I think, wonderful live coverage of the keynote there.
Thanks.
But, what did Tim say? That it sold out in like a minute?
73 like 90, seconds is Apple's official number.
So under 2 minutes. I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's kind of upsetting. You know, I mean, I've been to other industry events here, and it's like, well, I guess that's how many people they can accommodate.
That's it. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, of course they could restructure the event to accommodate more people. But it would therefore naturally change the way it works. I did not get a ticket for WWDC proper either. I got a press badge that was only good for the keynote and then turned into a pumpkin. But so I was able to see that. But because I'm a registered developer, and I think you are too, John, you can watch
yes.
all of the sessions, and they're out now. Like sessions from yesterday and possibly even sessions from this morning are already out. They're pushing them out really fast. So there's good stuff. Obviously the stuff other than the keynote, the stuff in the sessions is all under, Apple's NDA, but, for background stuff, John, at the very least watching the session, and I recommend this to all developers who are not here and didn't see it, even if you are here, watching Apple's Platforms State of the Union, which is the presentation that happens right after the keynote, goes into a lot more depth on a few of the things that happened or that were announced in the keynote. And really, certainly if you're a developer, gives you some valuable information that you just need. And even for us kind of covering this industry, John, even though we can't talk about it, it gives us background information, which is, again, hugely valuable just to kind of have to better understand the way things work. So, it's fun.
But the logistics, I got to say, I was very impressed because a few of us had a Mac roundtable about it. And the thing is, they had, and I don't know if they've always done this. They seem to be getting better. I seem to recall that they didn't always have this, but they had the video up within a couple hours of it ending.
Mm. Well, and they had the live stream going, too, that you could watch during the event.
Right.
Yeah.
So number one, they had the live stream. Number two, they had after the fact, they had it available to people who were unable to catch it live. So well, that was very helpful because so we could figure out what to talk about. But
yeah, that's right.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you want to dive into the keynote there, but my first impression is that everybody presented very well. I think you commented that some people looked like they had coaching. I think some had more than others, but to me it was very smooth, very energetic, very inspiring. From what all the guys presented, and even the Johnny Ive thing, I thought, got kind of philosophical. I thought that was pretty neat, too.
Yeah, it was interesting. I agree with you that the presentations were well. They were done well. People were appropriately emotional, I think is probably the right way to say that. But I thought it was really interesting, for weeks, in recent weeks, and then certainly even over the last couple of months, Apple has publicly mentioned mentioned Johnny Ive as one of the key people around whom the company is hung, right? On whose back this company is going to rest right now. And And I wondered, and he was there. I saw him before the keynote. He was actually chit-chatting with Al Gore and Tim Cook. But if you've watched the keynote, you know this. And if you haven't, Johnny Ive never appeared on stage. He appeared in the keynote in the fashion that, thankfully for Apple, I think, he always has, so there was no change. He was in pre-produced videos talking about things, and very well spoken, and as he always is. But it's interesting.
Isn't that weird? Is he just not good at live presenting?
I suppose that's the case. You know, I was thinking about this. I'm like, oh, yeah, we've never seen him speak live, and that's not true. At the Steve Jobs, I'll call it eulogy, they did a thing on the Apple campus within the week after Steve passed, and Coldplay performed, and they had various people speak, and one of those people was Johnny Ive, and I seem to remember him being very well spoken, and you know, what he said was very heartfelt. So I'm not sure why they don't put him on stage. Maybe he gets, maybe he doesn't prefer to speak live. Maybe he has a fear of that. You know, I mean, live speaking isn't for everyone, but I just thought it was interesting that they used him in that capacity. Thankfully for them, though, this is nothing new. He's been doing it that way ever since, you know, he's been at the company. Hmm. So we're getting some comments in the chat room of people saying, yeah, he's just not dynamic. He's a little too methodical. And so it's better to have him in bite-sized chunks, perhaps. And I will say hello to everyone in the chat room at MacGeekGab.com/stream, joining us in this weird, for us, time slot in the middle of a Wednesday. But thank you. And we actually, I really do want to thank the folks in the chat room, John, because they were on our mobile setup, which doesn't have at home in the studio. I can hear what I hear in my ears is what's being recorded to tape. So if something's missing, I know it immediately. With the mobile setup, I apparently or evidently don't get that. But thankfully, the people in the chat room do. So they told us earlier before the show started that they couldn't hear you, John, or couldn't hear the music or whatever. And so we sorted that out. So thanks, folks. It's good. But yeah, John, let's dig in a little bit. Go ahead.
Well, one of the quotes that I liked, so to get to his video, which I think was very good to express Apple's design philosophy, but one of the statements, and I'm taking it from you know another podcast they did, but I thought it was just a very powerful statement that he made, and it really summed up, I think, what Apple does, and it's a short one here, but he said, "True simplicity is derived from so much more than the absence of clutter and ornamentation. It's about bringing order to complexity." And that's just such a designer,
yeah,
designer statement. And it actually brings me back to another phrase that I've heard people bring up as of late is, and I think it was in something long ago. I don't think it's published anymore. Called the Macintosh Bible, but it basically had, and one of their commandments was, "Easy is hard, and hard is easy," and that it's really easy to make something that's hard to use, but it's really hard to make something that's easy to use. And I think that dovetails into this statement is that, you know, you still get the feeling when you use most Apple stuff or almost all Apple stuff with a couple of exceptions, you get the feeling that somebody thought about the user experience and how to make your life
totally
better and make it easier and make it intuitive. You know, others do it as well, but I think Apple, you know, usually gets it right the first time.
The first time we see it. Yes.
Right.
Right. Wait, yeah, I mean, they clearly work on an iterative process and aren't afraid to throw things out and start over when they realize it's a problem.
That was another one. I just want to punch this one in here. The other one is the intro, the very first video.
Yeah.
And this is what I love. The very first, I think, the video that they showed at the beginning. One of the other statements that struck me as very powerful is there are 1,000 no's for every yes.
Yep. Yeah.
Which I think is exactly what you just, your observation is, you know, a lot is happening behind the scenes that you never see the blood and gore involved in designing something improperly. But
totally.
We see the final product.
Yeah. You know, I feel like with iOS 7, I mean, obviously they're making a huge change and I think it's necessary to make a change. You know, the iOS 6 is basically the same generic type of UI as iOS 1 was. I mean, it's changed over time, but it's the same foundation. And iOS 7 obviously is them moving a little more forward. And it's a move that they couldn't have made without retina screens. You know, it used to be that they were doing their best with shadows and shading to compensate for the fact that edges were going to be rough or pixelated because you could see it. And now with iOS 7, of course, it runs, I believe, only on retina devices. And the edges are actually celebrated as edges. You know, there's hard edges. And I think that's good. It makes for a cleaner design. What I worry about is and I noticed this during the keynote and dug into it a little bit more last night, and I even put up an article on TMO today, that there's a lot of inconsistency. And I think I'm not sure that we can chalk that up to being, well, it's beta. And specifically what I'm talking about is in the buttons, which is something Apple's really touting as this big part. You know, if you look in Safari on iOS 7, and you can see this online, there's nothing confidential about any of this. I pulled screenshots from their pages online. You know, Safari has these one pixel wide, very clean type buttons, wireframe almost, no words. And then you look in the music app, and it's got these much richer buttons with color and words underneath them. And then you look in the Photos app, and it's sort of this hybrid of the two, where you've got sort of wireframes that are somewhat filled in, but still having words. And I get that it's a beta, but it's a beta being shown to developers saying, follow what we're doing here so that your apps match what we're doing when we release iOS 7. So I'm curious to see where this shakes out. Like or hate the new UI, I'm more focused on, can you please just deliver something consistent so that developers know what to do? And we'll find out. So,
okay. Maybe a bit about OS 10.9.
Yeah. You read my mind. Let's dig into some of the cool stuff in Mavericks.
We've been doing this for, not yet. I'm sorry. It's not yet, Dave, right? Isn't it tomorrow?
Tomorrow, yes.
Isn't tomorrow our big day?
Tomorrow is
what
the big day.
What big day may some of you may be wondering, what is tomorrow? And it's our birthday.
It is.
Right, Dave?
Yeah. June 13th will mark 8 years of us doing this show. Yeah. Happy birthday, John. Happy anniversary, I guess, is a more appropriate term.
Better buy some flowers or something. Yes, but I'm sure. So OS 10.9, so I'll get it out of the way right at the beginning. I would have been thrilled that they called it Sea Lion. I thought he was joking for us. Personally, I would have liked that versus including the Sea Lion. I mean, you know, it's very San Francisco. You can go to
totally.
You know, you can go to Fisherman's Wharf and you can see the, I think they're sea lions, right?
They are.
You know, hanging out there. And, but Mavericks, to me, it almost got kind of snooty. Like, you know, oh, well, you know, if you're from California and a surfer, then you'll know what Mavericks is. Otherwise, you won't have a clue.
Well, there was that big movie last year, Surfing Mavericks, that was actually quite popular.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I saw, no, come on. So the name, okay, you know, they're taking a different direction.
Exactly. But, it was actually a fantastic movie. I highly recommend it.
Okay, but I'm just saying that Mavericks will be lost to most of the world as far as what is the significance.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, was there a significance to cats?
Well, everybody knew what they were. You know, I mean, almost everybody knows what different, you know, felines are.
Yeah.
You know, I think it resonates with most people, but Mavericks, to me, is very, you know, northern. I think it's Northern California specific, so whatever.
Yeah.
I think right, they
okay,
East
so
Coast.
Let's get past. Let's move past the name, because we're not going to care about it. See, I am in a self restrained 72-hour period here, because change resistance is something that's normal in everyone to different degrees, of course, but 72 hours is typically what it takes for us as humans to begin to start to get over that. So I have no opinions on any of these names or, you know, any of that stuff yet.
Okay. So my first question, have you grokked or have they published any information as far as the hardware requirements? I fear that
I don't think they have.
Cause I think I'm going to guess that my MacBook Pro early 2008 may not be eligible.
Yeah,
I'm sure my mini is. I have a 2010 mini, so I'm sure that the mini will run it, but I don't know if they're going to build in, if they're going to include some of the, you know, older hardware like my MacBook Pro.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can't dig into, I, off the top of my head, I honestly don't know what the developer preview requires. And the places that I
could look. Well, let me download it and see if it installs.
Right. Well, that's a good test. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. It's, I have not installed it yet. So I have no fear of breaking any NDAs. The thing, you know, there's, listen, the Finder with tabs. This is a good thing. You know, and it seems,
finally,
I know, it seems like it's,
because I know you love tabs for certain apps. And I think, well, you know, personally though, I mean, I'm still a total Finder fan, and I hope they still get business, because, you know, a lot of times, you know, what Apple has done is, you know, like people call it, you know, they Sherlocked it.
Right.
Which is basically, you know, they put a feature in the OS, which, you know, an independent developer had come up with previously, and it's going to happen. Yeah, but I think Total Finder is still worth, in my mind, the money for the functionality it offers. And I think Apple will do a basic implementation, but Total Finder is still, hopefully... offer some move there.
But so nice, I want to dig into some of the tech details, but I want to dig into some of the techie stuff. But I, you brought up a point that now we have to address, is the Sherlocking thing. And certainly, it can be argued that 1Password, is in that situation now because of iCloud keychain. But, you know, I have a thought on this. BusyCal, had they released BusyCal before iCal came out, and they did not, but had they done that, then the same thing would have been said about BusyCal. Oh my God, Apple's released a calendar app. You're going to be Sherlocked, you know? And Sherlocked is the term we use because Sherlock was one of the first, search things that Spotlight sort of usurped its purpose, and off it went. But if you look at what happened, that's not what happened with BusyCal. In fact, iCal existed before BusyCal ever was conceived, or certainly before it hit the market. And they hit the market anyway and pitched themselves as iCal Pro, or now Calendar Pro. And they've had a great run of success with that because Apple, you know, focuses on very specific things and making things very simple for people to use. And that doesn't provide all the features that everyone wants, and that's what opens the door to these third parties, and it's why BusyCal could enter the market after iCal was released. And I think 1Password and people like Total Finder have the ability now to, you know, capitalize on this. Say, hey, look, you know, Apple's included this. This is really important, and you can certainly go with Apple's implementation. Or if you want it to work on all your browsers and not just Safari, and if you want it to do these other features like secure notes and all this, and tie it all together and sync with your Windows machines and use Chrome and all of that, then you use 1Password. And Total Finder has the same situation because they have way more features than just the tabs. Yes, that's the biggest one. That's one of the most popular ones. But it's not the only thing it does. So I think these companies are okay, or could be okay, if they play their cards right. But let's get into the tech. Can we? Can we?
Oh yes. Well, here's. So I'm going to throw out one tech thing that I think is really powerful.
Yeah, go.
Compressed memory.
Yeah. So how much of this? This is one thing. I'm glad you brought it up because I've been looking forward for 3 days to talking about this with you. So what do you understand about this compressed memory thing? I'm curious.
Well, to me, it looks like they're basically. So the way it works now is that you have two types of memory. You have active and inactive. And a lot of times, recently used memory is put in an inactive state. And my understanding is that basically the compressed memory will take that inactive stuff and, compress it. It's more efficient memory management is basically my takeaway from that.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. No, this makes sense. So it's actually compressing, like data compression, the stuff that's in inactive memory. And because it's in inactive memory, it's safe to compress it because, well, let's look at it this way, right? If you had run out of RAM, what it would do is it would take the stuff in inactive memory and save it off to the disk, which is infinitely slower than reading from RAM. And so what they're doing is finding sort of a middle ground. Reading something that's compressed requires it to be decompressed, but that's still way faster than reading from the disk. So
right. So what they're doing is it's, and I think it's, and looking at it, to me, it makes sense, especially since they introduced something like, you know, some of the newer MacBook Airs, which have relatively little RAM and hard drive, especially if you get a SSD versus some of the, you know, like the MacBook Pro. So I think it makes sense because I think you're still, especially with like the MacBook Air, you're pushing the limits. If you run any amount of apps and all that, you're going to reach the point where you're going to run out of RAM or start hitting the hard drive. So to me, it makes sense that to make that process more efficient. And actually, you know, I just did a quick search here on the Googles. And, you know, what's funny is that, you know, things kind of come around is, remember RAM Doubler?
Oh, that's what it did.
I think basically what they're doing is very similar to something called a product way in the past called RAM Doubler, which basically kind of did the same thing. It was using compression to effectively give you more available RAM than you actually had.
Oh, so it's wow. Nice to see it. Yeah, that makes... I'd totally forgotten about RAM Doubler. Huh. Huh. Well, okay, yeah. So that's cool. That's, you know, the okay, so the other thing I wanted to talk about was AppNap, right, where it's intelligently putting things to sleep in the background, right? Or only waking things up in the background less frequently. And it seemed like from what we saw in the keynote that this was happening not when an app was, and I may be kind of blending in what's happening with Safari's Power Saver with AppNap, but it was when the app was visible, and it didn't matter if it was foreground or not. If an app was in the background and visible, and this is certainly true with the Safari Power Saver, it still runs at full tilt. But as soon as you slide another window in front of it, off it goes, which I think is cool.
You know, that kind of bothered me, though, in that I kind of assumed with my background, having all these pieces of paper saying I know about computers and stuff, but I was actually kind of surprised that an app that's doing graphics, if it's not visible, it's actually chewing up processor doing that. Yeah. I kind of assumed that the OS was smart enough. It's like, well, if you can't see it, why should I be doing this? But apparently,
well, think about it though.
OS 10 and maybe even Windows and other OSs are, you know, kind of, to me, I almost would think that's kind of a natural, it should be a natural feature of an OS, is that, you know, if you can't see, if I'm rendering something, but the person can't see it, maybe I shouldn't render it.
That I agree with you.
Right?
Yes, totally. But only in the circumstance where it is being rendered for the sole purpose of the person at the computer viewing it, right? So if you're doing some other sort of rendering in the background you're going to save out to a file when it's finished or whatever, that should continue in the background, right? You know, perhaps with lower CPU priority or something, but you still want it to happen. But yes, with a web browser, which is a very specific thing, games might also be considered in this category, right? As soon as it's in the background, invisible, then yeah, there's no reason to generate it, at least not as fast. Yeah, it's cool. It seems like AppNap. This Safari Power Saver is sort of part of this AppNap thing, where it's hiding, or it's deprioritizing and even stopping some apps running in the background. I think it's awesome. I think it's awesome.
Yep. Now another thing, thank goodness, Dave, because I think it'll result in relatively fewer questions for us. But you probably noticed this too. But apparently, somebody noticed that their multiple display support currently sucks.
Somebody at Apple got a second display.
It's very inconsistent.
Oh, it's not inconsistent. It just doesn't work.
It doesn't work the way people would like it to.
Full screen mode with multiple displays doesn't work. Right. Yeah, multiple displays works, but yeah. Well, no, you're right, because they've solved the full screen mode issue. You can have an app in full screen on one display and still Windows on the other, or an app in full screen on every or all of your displays. But then they also allow you to have the dock on all displays, which is, you know, super handy. So that's good.
Yeah. And another thing I think we talked about the, we talked about iCloud Keychain, right?
Yes.
Now the thing is,
we didn't talk too much about it. We referenced it with 1Password. iCloud Keychain will manage your passwords for Safari and sync them amongst all your devices, including your iOS devices, which is cool. Yeah.
Because if I recall, MobileMe did this.
Only amongst your Macs.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. And it
did. So it's nice to see that. And I don't think it's going to, you know, like, you know, again, the whole Sherlock thing, but I don't think it's going to displace people. Like, I'm a LastPass fan. I love LastPass. Right. I think you're a 1Password fan.
Yep.
And you know, this is a basic functionality that probably should have been there to begin with. But the other thing I noticed, Dave, was in an article that you wrote or someone wrote, but I think that the people have suggested that they're going to introduce a iCloud reset, which is something a lot of us, did you pen that or someone, I thought someone at TMO penned it.
If I were to have penned it, then it would, I don't think, I certainly had nothing to do with it being penned at TMO. Because I'm pretty sure that wasn't announced in the keynote. Why don't we say it that way?
All right. Okay. All I know is that I did see
But I have
articles.
Seen it on the web. Else, yes. I don't know if we did it at TMO or not, to be brutally honest.
Okay.
But yes. But
I've seen people, now maybe they broke the NDA, which is, you know,
sounds
sad.
Like they might.
But,
have.
Well, but you know, I mean, the thing is, Dave, I mean, the based on the number of, and especially my horror show of, you know, iCloud not working right with the documents and settings and stuff like that. To me, it's not a big revelation that maybe this should be a feature that should be.
Oh, can you imagine what support requests for Apple would be like if a developer or an app developer could tell a customer, look, you just got to reset your data and could actually reset it on the cloud? That'd be awesome. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that coming. Yeah.
So I saw suggestions that they're going to offer to the user a way to clean the iCloud slate when things get screwed up. Like in my case, I definitely saw it. It was like permissions were wrong and everything was totally munched.
Oh yeah.
To be technical.
Yeah.
And I was lucky enough to be able to rebuild it to a state where it was usable. But yeah, they need to that needed to happen. iCloud's good, but it could be better.
Yeah.
What else in the OS caught your attention?
You know, I'm trying to look here. It may be time. I mean, there's some other geeky things, but whole timer coalescing thing where they're trying to just make it more power efficient, I think is good. Mm-hmm. But you know, I mean, it, yeah. I think
I like
I'm ready
this one.
To move on to iOS 7 when you're. Go ahead.
Okay. Yep. One last thing I saw: Maps. What I thought was very clever, and again, just the, you know, somebody put thought into this, is so they were showing, you know, a Maps demo, and the thing that struck me that was very cool is like, let me schedule an event that triggers when I should leave.
No, that's like Maps and
that
calendar.
Was so cool. So it's like I want to drive to your place, Dave, in New Hampshire. So allegedly, you know, if I put it into the new Maps, it will then offer me the option saying, okay, well, you know, I know the traffic and stuff like that. So, John, you should probably leave, you know, about, I think it's like 3 hour drive or 3.5 hour drive.
Sure.
Between us. And to me, that's just a wonderful usability win.
And it also blocks out your calendar for travel, or can, at your option, block out your calendar for travel time. So you won't be scheduling, you know, if you have a 1 o'clock meeting an hour away, well, scheduling a 12:30 meeting is not feasible. You and I know this. It's crazy that up until now, no calendar software has done it. I'd always kind of look to the BusyCal guys to, you know, to do that because they do a lot of cool things. But yeah.
All right.
Hey,
so
you know what?
Next, iOS 7.
Yeah, go ahead. Go. Yeah. No, we'll go to iOS 7. I did an interview today, and I got some juicy information, juicy technical information, but we'll talk about it in a minute. Go ahead. iOS 7 is good.
Well, I'll let you start because I kind of glossed over.
Okay. Like I said, I'm refraining from having an opinion about the new layout for a variety of reasons for right now. But I do like, there's two things that, I mean, it just awesome and I think done very well. Control Center has been necessary and desired for what the last three iOS releases, something to very quickly turn on airplane mode and Bluetooth and set your volume and all of that. So that was an obvious omission from iOS. Anybody that jailbroke their phone, the first thing you would install was SB settings so that you could have this functionality. Many of us who jailbroke our phones did it solely for that functionality, that myself included. So it's great to see that coming into iOS proper, that's necessary. So very happy about that. And the other is the way they're doing multitasking. This was something that had to happen.
That's always been a point of, I think, confusion in general, Dave, in the iOS world, is that so the conventional line that most people offer is that if an app is not in front, it's not doing anything. Though there are some exceptions, and I think that's what they tried to address with this better multitasking, in that I think most users assume if an app's not up front, it's not doing anything. It's not consuming any processor or bandwidth.
Well, but I mean, okay, that hasn't been
entirely accurate.
That hasn't been true for a while, right? I mean, with because multitasking is not new to iOS, right? We've had it with music apps, with navigation apps, right? Things that are obviously needing to run in the background and could get the developer, when they write the app, says, I need to multitask and here's why, and so they provision it that way. But what's great about this is they're doing it. You know, I mean, listen, there's a lot of people with smart ideas, but they're doing it in a way that I think is really, really smart. I have apps that sit in the background on my phone, and I don't need every one of them to check, like a weather app or even like Triage, my third-party email management app. I would love for that thing to go out and be able to check for email on in the background, but I don't need it to do it on its schedule. You know, if I say every 15 minutes I want this app to go in the background and check email, that's fine. But what if I have another app that I say every 15 minutes I want you to check for something, but they're doing it 3 minutes apart? Well, now I'm checking, I'm firing up a network connection, which is very costly from a power standpoint. And what they're doing is this piggybacking thing where an app can say, hey, once an hour, but not any more frequently than every 15 minutes, I want to go get some data. And so they just like hang their little hook on, they hang their request on the hook. And the OS comes through and says, oh, it's time. We know what everybody needs. So we're going to go ahead and make a network request. And this fits within your parameters, Mr. Application. So we're going to go ahead and do your network request too. We'll let you know what we get. And I think it's brilliant. It's absolutely perfect. It's the right way to do it because you're doing one network connection, then everything stops. And so you're very power efficient and even network efficient.
Yeah.
So it's good. Yeah.
So they refine the multitasking model because, for those that don't know, but just a little primer here. So there are, basically two types of multitasking. One is called cooperative, which is what early OSs did, which basically the app said, I'm running the show here, and when I want to give up the processor, then I will. And then the other is preemptive, I believe, multitasking,
right?
Which is, everybody, the OS kind of schedules everybody, based on their needs and, when they say they want stuff and all that. And but it sounds like they refined it, especially in light of the fact that, certain operations on a portable device are very expensive. And I think we've all seen this, is that especially when things are running location services, your battery gets sucked dry.
Yeah, network access and location, depending on how they're doing location services. I mean, a lot of times location services doesn't use the GPS chip at all, right? You can set what level of location you want to get. And if it's just getting it from cell and Wi-Fi, the assisted stuff, that's actually not all that costly. And you can tell the thing, update only when it makes sense. So, yeah, but network access is a big one. Yeah. Yeah, it's good.
So a couple other points about iOS 7. App Store automatic updates.
Now that we get that like, in OS 10 too.
My read on this, though, was that it'll happen there's an option where it will happen whether you want it to or not, and I do not approve of that.
Well, that's that. But what you just said was there's an option whether you want it or not, and there's an option, and if you want it, you get it.
Okay.
And if you don't want it,
so you can't turn it off. Okay.
That was my. I have not used it, so I can't speak definitively. But that was the my interpretation was, if you can turn this auto updates on, and then it just happens, which is freaking awesome. By the way, for me, it drives me crazy. To go and, you know, like we're getting ready to go on a trip or something. No, my family never updates their apps. And so we're getting ready to go on a trip and like, you know, we use Plex in the house. And suddenly everybody says, oh, I'm having trouble getting Plex to work with the server. It's like, oh, well, when was the last time you updated the apps on your iPhone? You know, you look at the icon on their app store and it's at like, you know, 78 or something. It's like, oh, dude, you got to pay attention to this. Now they don't have to pay attention. Now I just will set it and it'll update in the background and they're happy. And if you're a geek and you know, like us, and you want to know what the changes are before you press the update button, hey, I think I'm 99% certain that that is still an option. So, yeah, that's good.
The photo update I think is cool. And this was another quote that I thought was great is, who said it? I forgot who was presenting it, but he said
Craig Federighi.
Probably, yes. And the one statement that I thought was awesome, he was like, this is what their photo organization looks like. An endless unorganized stream of their camera roll, but it doesn't have to be this way.
Yeah. And I'm curious to see where that goes. I mean, this is one of those things where and it's the only way to begin to solve this problem. Apple has to come up with an organizational scheme and then they impose it on all of us. But that's better than no organizational scheme, I think. So let's see what happens.
Well, people have been trying to do this, Dave. I mean, whether it be iPhoto or Aperture or Lightroom or whatever. And actually, one thing that a lot of my Mac friends, especially photographers, both pro, semi-pro and all that, were very disappointed that Apple seems to be neglecting Aperture, which is very sad because it's a very powerful app, and especially since the price drop. I like Aperture, but they seem to be ignoring it, which is, again, sad. Other programs are you know, passing it as far as abilities and all of that. But the thing is, people have, for the most part, you know, with the assistance of apps like iPhoto or Aperture or Lightroom, have been coming up with their own way of organizing their photos. You know, some of the apps have tried, you know, whether it be, you know, with the EXIF data or, you know, when the photo was taken and stuff embedded in the photo to organize it in a way that makes sense. But it sounds like, you know, I think everybody agrees that there could be a better way to automate this so that the apps, like, you know, hopefully iOS 7 will do a better job of organizing this in a manner that makes sense to people and makes it easier for you to get to the photos that you want.
Yeah, totally. All right. I want to talk about, I think that's a good spot to wrap up. I'm sure we'll obviously revisit these things when they come out and certainly as questions come in and all that stuff. But that's as good a spot to wrap this WWDC portion of our chat up. So I will, there is one tip that I want to share and there's actually lots that we want to share and we've got some time. So the first thing I want to do is talk about our first sponsor, which is Gazelle. Gazelle.com is an excellent place to go if you need to sell your old Apple hardware. So let's say, for example, that you took a look and see that you've got an iPhone 3GS, which is not going to run iOS 7 according to Apple, right? We need iPhone 4 and later. You need something with Retina. Well, go ahead and sell your 3GS to Gazelle and take that cash and go buy, you know, maybe an iPhone 5 with that, or even a, you know, a 4S. And the way you do it, it's awesome. And they make it so easy. You go to gazelle.com, you tell them you have something to sell. You say, I have an iPhone. They ask what model, what size, what condition it's in. And then they tell you a price. And if you like the price, they send you a box free of charge. In the box is instructions and a piece of tape and some packing material, really creative packing material. What they do is they have this like floating piece of cardboard inside the box, and over the cardboard is a piece of plastic, and it's tight. and you take the iPhone and you slide it under the piece of plastic. So it's kept right in there, but there's no packing peanuts and foam, and it's really just kind of held in there. And it's a nice sturdy box. And so you close up the box, you put the tape on it, you put the label on it, and send it back to them. Again, no charge to you. Once they get it, they open it up, evaluate it, make sure that it is what you said it was, and also that the condition matches what you said. If it is, they send you your money immediately. If there's any questions, they will email you and say, hey, look, we evaluated it. It's actually a 3G, not a 3GS, or it's good condition as opposed to excellent, or sometimes it's excellent and not good. And so they'll say, we want to offer you a different amount of money, sometimes more, sometimes less. And if you agree, well, then they send you your money. If you don't agree, they send you your device back. Again, free of charge. So all the shipping is paid for by them, and it happens really, really fast. So if you have anything that you need to send to Gazelle, or that you need to sell, sell it to Gazelle. Gazelle.com. Sometimes it's fun just to take a look there so you get a kind of a feel in your head of what things are worth. Maybe you have an iPad 3 like me. Someday you might want an iPad mini. It's fun to go and look and think, okay, well, you know, actually that offsets the cost of the mini. Maybe I can do that. You know, so check it out. Gazelle.com to sell all your stuff off. So I promised that I had a tip, John. I had an interview today that is one that I've been wanting to have for years.
Oh.
Yep. And it happened literally just before I came up to
record. You gave me a heads up, but I think this is a program that you and I both love to death.
Yes. So I met with Alf Watt, who most of you know as the brains behind, the developer behind iStumbler. And iStumbler is a program that, if you haven't used it, it's very handy. It allows you to see what it does is it goes out and pulls all of the wireless networks and devices around you, shows you everything, and really then becomes a handy tool to help you decide where to place your base station, what channel to put your base station on, and all of that stuff. So John, you and I have talked about iStumbler many times. Well, last year, I believe it was last year, maybe 2 years ago, I emailed Alf and said, as I do with many people, hey, I'm going to be at WWDC. I would love to interview you. And he wrote back and said, oh, yeah, I love it. You guys talk about iStumbler all the time, but there's no freaking way I can let you interview me because I work for Apple. And I'm like, oh, I didn't realize that.
Really?
As it turns out, Alf, he worked for Apple.
So wait, you can't interview people that, what, do they have a, well, I guess you got to go through their PR.
I would have to go through PR channels. Right. Exactly. Okay. Yeah. And when Alf was at Apple, he worked on and wrote the wireless software for Mac OS X. So here we were being able to use this utility to help us, this free utility from Alf to iStumbler to help us decide what to use, where to put our wireless networks. And it was written by the same guy that was writing the airport code that was in all of the Macs that we were then going to use. And so I was very excited about that. But Alf has moved on. He left Apple sometime in the past year, so I was able to interview him. And that interview will go up on TMO at some point over the next couple of days. And it was a fantastic interview. He's obviously a total wireless geek. And in the middle of the interview, I had one of those moments, John, where, you know, the heavens opened and I had inspiration. And I asked him, I said, wait a minute, I've got you here. I need to ask a question. I said, what's your opinion on SSID names with mixed networks? So if I have a 2.4, if I have a base station, which many of us have, that has both 2.4 and 5 gigahertz, or even two different base stations serving that same thing, but all on the same network, should I name the networks the same, or should I name them different? So should I have, you know, Dave 2.4, Dave 5 gigahertz, or should I just call the network Dave? And
based
without,
on what I've seen in at least my last corporate encounter, or at least, you know, big corporate encounter, they would name it the same. They'd be like, whatever you get, you get. It's like, all right, we're going to name it all, you know, company name, whatever, and whatever you pick up, you pick up, and hopefully you pick up the best one.
Yeah, and that was Alf's advice. He said, you name it exactly the same. And he said, you let the devices figure it out. Now, he's trusting the devices, and understandably so, he wrote them. You know, so I get that. But yeah. So but I've seen it before where, you know, you have to pick 5 gigahertz versus 2.4 gigahertz. And so that's how I had always set my network up at home. But I will change that now as soon as I get home and let my devices sort it out for themselves. And he went into great detail as to why this is and bandwidth of channels and all of this. And again, that'll be in the interview. And if the audio of the interview is good enough, I will put up the raw audio for you all to hear too. So,
well, yeah. You know, I found it funny, Dave, because my most recent experience in a corporate environment was that I got one of the latest iMacs, and the environment I was in had a Cisco, I think somewhat dated, access point. And so I fired up the iMac, said connect to this, gave it the password. Sadly, they were using WEP, which,
we could crack that with our iPhones, John.
Yeah, I could crack that, you know, my sleep. No, but the funny thing is that for whatever reason, the iMac chose to connect to it at 802.11a 5 gigahertz. I'm like, really? Really? But apparently it made the right choice because apparently, from what I could see, that was, so I think there has to be some decision making in the, Wi-Fi stack all right, here's the options that are available to me. So obviously it's not just 802.11a and 5 gigahertz, but it probably also, it did have 2.4 gigahertz and other stuff. And I don't know why it made the decision, but it looked to be the best one.
Was your router not N capable?
Oh, no, it was. Oh, no, it had N, G, and A.
Then I would,
and I think B.
I would ask, I'll ask Alf about this, but my feeling is that it made a terrible decision because
really. Very close to it, Dave.
No, I know why.
So the thing is,
hang on. So I'll tell you why I think made a terrible decision, and then I'll tell you why it made this decision. Yeah. So terrible decision because 802.11a is limited to 54 megabytes a second, right? Megabits a second. Sorry,
you told me about this. Yes.
Yeah. So 802.11
WEP.
No. 802.11a over 5 gigahertz, which is the only bandwidth that it can or the only spectrum it can use, is 802.11a is 54 megabytes a second. That's it. The same as 802.11g. It just happened that one happens to be 2.4 gigahertz. If you had 802.11n available, there's no good reason, except one, which you alluded to, that you wouldn't choose n instead of A, because N can go 300 versus 54. Doesn't mean it's going to go 300, but certainly why not have the headroom and why not have the more efficient data transfer? And the reason is WEP. 802.11n cannot work with WEP encryption. It is part of the spec of 802.11n that it is not allowed to let you connect with WEP encryption.
It could, but it won't.
No,
because
Technically, it could, but
they put this limitation in, I think, and it makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. You bet you can do it with no encryption. And the reason is the Wi-Fi group wanted to ensure that people had secure connections when they thought they had secure connections. And so if you have no password, you know it's not secure. But if you have a password, it cannot be WEP. And that's why it chose A, because it couldn't choose N. Yeah. Yeah. Actually, it could choose N. You can choose N, but it will limit you to 54 megabytes a second, is how that works. So, yeah. Yeah, interesting stuff. So I maintain that I still think it made a stupid decision because it could have chosen N and limited it to 54.
Actually, now that I think about it, I think this access point may not have had... I don't know if it had N.
Yeah. Yeah, well, then it makes sense. Yeah. All right.
Where are we, Dave?
Yeah, let's go through some commentary from the last show.
Good.
The first thing I wanted to address was we talked about the plus sign when putting phone numbers into the iPhone. We got a ton of email. Thank you, everybody, about this.
We are woefully untraveled, Dave.
Well, we're very... Yes,
you
we're
and I are not very well traveled because for people that travel internationally, I think that... And this was the feedback that I think both you and I saw... is that this is pretty much what people do.
Yeah, but if you travel internationally,
international calls,
and you don't know this, this is handy stuff. So Simon wrote, and thank you to everybody in addition to Simon who wrote into us, but I'm just going to read the one. Simon wrote, you asked in episode 452, what is the plus sign used for when dialing phone numbers? Simply put, it is the country exit code, which varies depending upon the country that you are calling from when you are calling another country. When dialing abroad, the number you would dial would take the following format: exit country, then the country code, then the city code, then the local exchange, then the local number. Sometimes, in various countries and cities, the local exchange and local number is one merged string. It all dates back to the days of fixed landline phones, which we remember having just 12 keys, 0 through 9, star, and pound. But before that, had dials of just 0 through 9. When automatic exchanges were introduced, initially through mechanical pulse dialing, and then electronic exchanges, this format became internationally standard. You could then dial any phone anywhere in the world from any other phone. But if you were in the same exchange, you just dialed the local number. If you're in the same city but different exchanges, you would then dial the exchange code and the local number, etc., etc. All the country codes are the same regardless of what country you're calling from. North America, including USA, Canada, and Caribbean, is 1. UK is 44. France is 33, and so on. However, the country exit code does vary depending on the country you're calling from. The country exit code from the USA is 011, but from the UK, it is 00. So to call the same number in France, country code 33, from the US, you would dial 01133, and then the number. But from the UK, you would dial 0033. Mobile phones, cellular phones, adopted a standard which gets around this by replacing the country exit code with plus. So that way, no matter what country you're in, you will automatically dial the correct exit code. Thank you so much, Simon. You put that together in a way that certainly made me understand it perfectly, and hopefully everybody else as well. So thank you.
So it sounds to me like the phone has to be aware of where it is, and then it will do the right thing when it sees the plus.
And presumably the phone is aware of where it is if it has a signal, because it's right. Going, yeah. Well, but I don't even think the phone has to dial it. My understanding is the plus tells the local phone cell, get me out of the country. And so it's I don't think it's the phone doing the logic, but I may be wrong. But I think it's the local cell doing the logic. So I think we should do Todd, John, because I think this is one that you will have good things to say about. Shall we?
Okay, we'll skip. Yeah.
Yeah, we're running short on time. Yeah,
I think I will.
I think you will. All right. Let's hear it, Todd.
Hey, John, Dave, and Pilot Pete. This is Todd in Monticello, Minnesota. Quick question. I just recently got a Crucial M500 480 gigabyte SSD, and I'd like to enable trim, but I searched for trim on Google, and I don't know if I trust all of these odd websites. Could you post what it is?
Uh-oh. Oh, you know what? I screwed that up. Sorry, Todd.
If I trust all of these odd websites, could you post what it is that needs to be done in the terminal that will enable trim support for my new SSD? And as an aside question, also looking for an alternative to Flash. So there's extensions and plugins, possibly for Safari, that you could implement, but I've read some reviews and they're kind of iffy. If you have an answer for that one as well, that'd be great. Anyways, this is where you cut me off.
And I will cut you off again, this time at the right time. So very briefly, but not very, we won't get too deep into the technical aspects of it, or we'll see how deep we get. So when you have an SSD, you have it takes time to write data to it. And you can't write on a hard drive. You can write data to any spot on the drive. And if something was there previously, it will simply be overwritten. On an SSD, in order to write data to any spot on the drive, it needs to be empty first. And so if you go to write to something that has data, if it's not empty, you have to first empty it, which takes time, and then you can write to it. to make things faster for the user, there is an operating system-based construct or technology that's called TRIM, T-R-I-M. And what it does is it knows what things have been marked as erased but not actually erased on the SSD. And so it will, in the background, go out and when things aren't so busy on the drive, it will go out and erase these things. TRIM is only enabled on Apple-shipped SSDs. So if you have a third-party SSD, you don't automatically get the benefit of this TRIM. Third-party SSDs, because of this, have implemented their own what they call garbage collection. But their own garbage collection only will happen when the drive is idle and active. So if you have the system set to put your drive to sleep anytime it is not active, or anytime that would be idle, then it's possible this garbage collection would never happen. And then things would get really slow when you go to write to the drive as the drive fills up. So there's a couple of options here, and this is why Todd's asking about TRIM. One option would be to enable TRIM through an OS hack, and there is a thing called TRIM Enabler that will hack the OS to allow TRIM to be enabled for non-Apple drives. And the other is to go into Energy Saver and turn on or turn off the put the drive to sleep part so that the drive will stay on and do its garbage collection. I would go, and I know there's a lot of different advice out there, I would actually let the OS do it. If the drive supports TRIM, there's no reason not to, in my mind, no reason not to let the OS do that. Thoughts, John?
My only thought is that from what I've seen of the hacks, some of them, the way that the hack was done makes me nervous.
Okay.
And that I don't know if it's sustainable across OS versions and stuff like that. I would actually, I don't know, you may be shocked here, but I actually would probably shy away from second guessing what the SSD manufacturer does. And, you know, in the case of OWC and others, they have implemented their own alternative.
Well, that's the garbage collection, right, that I talked about.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah.
So I...
But that won't work. If you leave your OS at default settings, the garbage collection does not work the way it's supposed to. Because your hard drive will go to sleep, and it will never happen.
Yeah, as long as... So I guess to me, the quality of the TRIM hacks... So number one, you could get around this by buying an Apple SSD, of course.
Right.
But number two, I'm hesitant to support a hack that enables a feature that, you know, is normally not available. I don't know. Again, you would think, John, you're a geek and you should support hacking and getting the most performance, but it just makes me worry. And that if something isn't done right with this hack, that you know, things could go awry.
Yeah, well, and Apple is always errs on the side of being cautious with this stuff, right? But my feeling is if the drive itself advertises these TRIM enablers won't do anything if the SSD that you've bought doesn't support TRIM in the first place, right? It is a cooperative technology between the drive and the OS. So if the drive doesn't support it, nothing's going to happen. But if the drive...
Yeah, and it's basically the OS saying, hey, clean these up so the next time you see these cells, or whatever you want to call them,
yeah,
the writing will be quicker because they're clean. And I think that's really the essence of TRIM.
Right. That's exactly it. That's right. And the garbage collection does the same thing. But, I did a lot of research when Todd's question came in about... you know, what's going on with this garbage collection. And there's advice. And I mean, we're talking about from real vendors like Crucial and OWC and specifically with Crucial, I found a lot of posts that they put on their forums saying, yeah, so what you need to do in order to let the drive on a Mac, in order to let the drive do its own garbage collection is you need to manually trigger the garbage collection by starting up your Mac, but holding down Option so that you get the list of drives that you want to boot from, and then just let
The startup manager.
Yeah, exactly. The startup manager. And then let your Mac sit there for a while because the drive is powered up, but it is completely not being used. It's not even mounted. And that will kick in the automatic garbage collection. Now, you get no notification because it's just the drive doing it internally, and you have no idea when it's finished. But that was their solution to, you know, either that or you have to turn off the energy saver stuff. It's like, gosh, you know, we have this trim enabler thing, and I get that Apple's being cautious, but I think if you're buying drives from a high-quality vendor, I think you're okay with trim enabler. That's why we're different people. We have different opinions.
Yeah. Again, I would shy away. To me, the increase in speed and performance with an SSD is enough to discourage me from doing a hack to squeak out that, you know, I'm not sure, you know, if anybody's done metrics on this, it'd be great, but I'm not sure how much extra performance you get.
It can get pretty slow without trim.
Yeah, but again, you know, my point is you're going way beyond. I mean, the SSD performance is way beyond even the best mechanical drive. So it's like, right. You know, maybe
but
it's, maybe
but
it's
John,
good
you
enough
know how
you don't want to futz with it.
You know how it is. Once you have, right, if you're using if you're using the yes. speed of a mechanical drive as your baseline, I agree with you entirely. However, on day two of using an SSD, you are no longer using the speed of the mechanical drive as the baseline. You are using the speed of the SSD as the baseline.
Now you're like, this sucks. I want it fast.
I want it.
Yes, I understand.
Yeah. Right? You know what I mean? That's the thing. And and the deal is you wouldn't run into any of these problems for months because initially every sector on your drive is empty and writable. So it's only as you start churning things over on your drive that this kicks in. So you've long forgotten about how slow your mechanical drive was, and you are now in SSD land, and ain't no way you're going to, you know, want to wait for the double write, which is essentially what happens. So,
right. All right. Or write erase or
exactly. All right, pick a question, John. Anything, or you want to tell your TiVo story? We've got a little bit of time left here. A little bit of time.
You know, I think I'll tell my TiVo story
because
I think it probably applies maybe to not everybody listening, but certainly some. So, as some of you know, Dave and I are big fans of TiVo. What is TiVo? TiVo is a digital video recorder. What does it do? In essence, it records programs that you can view later, and it stores them on a hard drive. Okay, well, that's cool. You know, it's an interesting, hardware mix in that, you know, it uses open source technology and all that. But the thing that concerned me, Dave, is that now that I look at it, is that both you and I believe purchased our TiVo Series 3, which is quite dated now, superseded by others. But mine is almost 6 or 7 years old, and I think yours is too.
That's right.
And when I think about it, Dave, these have a hard drive just like any other device. And actually, I'm looking at it right here. I have it in front of me, Dave.
Yeah.
So the hard drive in the device, and again, I was kind of shocked that the hard drive lasted this long because to me, 7 years is a good...
Is it an enterprise grade drive?
Well, that's what I'm not sure. Some people said this, but basically, Dave, I'm looking at the drive. So the drive is a Western Digital WD2500BS. And it just says WD Caviar. So to me, this is, from what I could tell, Dave, this is just a basic Western Digital desktop drive, 3.5-inch form factor, right?
I'm looking it up online. You know, I mean, it's old, so the specs are, you know, buried a little bit. But yeah, it doesn't seem to be anything special. So yeah, you're right.
Yeah, so I think it's just the standard desktop drive. Now, the thing is, in the TiVo, I think the use of it is that it's pretty much running all the time, which I think in general, if you can do this, is probably the best option. In that you're not stressing the drive because it's always spinned up. There's always data being exchanged and stuff like that. And that's probably better than starting and stopping and starting and stopping and all that, which in, you know, my world means that a drive will fail more quickly if you're constantly, you know, telling it to do different things. But basically what I got, Dave, and let me find the link here.
Yeah, so, please.
Where is it? So basically, I found a link, a TiVo link. Yeah, I'll get it.
Okay. We'll put it in the show notes.
But basically, so I was like curious about this. So I'm like, you know what? This drive is getting to the end of its lifetime. What am I going to do? So the first thing I did is I looked up this drive, Dave, and then I found pretty much a compatible drive. I got it from B&H over in Brooklyn. And so this drive is a 250 gig drive. So I basically got what I consider the same class of drive. Now, oddly enough, Dave, getting this exact same drive cost more than getting a drive with double the capacity.
Of course. Yeah, because the old one was a 250. Is that right?
Yeah. So yeah. One tip to people. Yeah. So this is a 250. So the thing, one tip to people is that if you're going to upgrade old hardware, getting the exact same part will cost you probably more because it's nearing end of life and it's more expensive production wise and you get economies of scale and all that great stuff. So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to, even though I haven't really exceeded my TiVo hard drive space, I'm like, you know what? Let me get a 500 gig instead of a 250. So that's number one. Now, number two is, well, how do you do this? So number one, you have to pull out the screwdriver and you have to open up the TiVo.
Of course.
Which is basically, a Linux computer. And I think the drives actually use something called MFS. I believe it's Minix file system, which is something I actually encountered when I was doing my undergraduate work. So it is a file system, which, of course, the Mac doesn't recognize. So the tools you would need to do this. So a couple of the tools. So one, Dave, is, oh my gosh, I'm so glad I had these. And I actually have two of them because they sent me one and then they sent me a better one. But the newer drive, I'm trying to think of the proper name of it, but it's basically their drive.
The universal drive adapter?
Universal drive adapter. What is it? On one end, it's a USB 2 connector. I think it's right now USB 2. Maybe they have USB 3. I don't know.
It's USB 3
And on
3
the other
now.
End, they have upgraded it. Oh, maybe they'll send me another one. Because I had two. I had one an early model and one a later model. So they were both USB 2, and then they end in multiple adapters, either parallel ATA, SATA, or whatever. And this is probably the best way for most people to accomplish the task. So number one, buy a new drive. Number two, get a couple of these adapters or either an enclosure. And then number three, and here's the hard part. So, well, relatively hard part.
Yeah, I'm curious about this third part here because you've got a thing on the Minix file system, and you've got to do it precisely right so that your TiVo sees this new drive like its old one, right?
Right. So what I found was an article, and I think this is the best place. So it's the TiVo community forums. Now, TiVo is awesome in that they support people. Not under warranty, but they support people talking about how to hack and enhance their devices. So basically, I found this wonderful article here, and let me paste it in our awesome little chat room here. But basically, this is the thread that I found that told me how to do this. And so basically, I found the option here. So they're like, here's the options if you want to upgrade your TiVo. And the one that I found is option two, replace your built-in drive with a bigger drive. And then you click on a link saying upgrade instructions, and this got into it. And the real core of this, Dave, so one, you got to get the right screwdrivers, Torx 10 and Torx 15, to open up the TiVo, or at least the one we have. But again, once you do that, as long as you're not a, as long as you don't destroy electronics by looking at them, you then pull out the hard drive. But then you get a utility called WinMFS. Now you're saying, John, oh my gosh, this is a Windows utility. What am I going to do? Here's what I did, Dave. So I installed this. So I'm running Parallels 8. Are we up to 8?
We are.
Keep track.
Yep.
So basically, I got Parallels. So thank you, Parallels. It was a promotional copy here. And I, for this purpose, Parallels did perfect.
It was a review copy. There's no. It's not promotional. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You stop
review,
using
review,
that
I'm
word.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I won't.
Okay.
It was a review copy.
Yeah.
So Parallels 8, running that actually under Windows XP, Service Pack 3. But basically, I got this utility, and you'll see in the article, called, where is it?
WinMFS.
WinMFS. So yeah. What this utility does is basically understands this MFS kind of unusual file format. You want to be careful because if you plug in one of these SATA adapters, USB adapters, and you plug the drive in, Mac OS X is going to say, I don't know what this drive is. What do you want me to do? And it's like, sure. Initialize, ignore. And it's like, ignore, please. Do right. not initialize it. So it knows it's a drive. It knows it's a valid drive, but it doesn't recognize the file format or the partition scheme or whatever you want to call it. But this utility does. So basically what I did is I, and kind of the cool part about Parallels, Dave, so I had it on my MacBook Pro, but I wanted to run this utility on my Mini. So I basically took the Parallels virtual drive and brought it over, or the virtual drive file. So basically,
the virtual machine file,
the virtual machine file. So I basically took that and took it from my MacBook Pro because I didn't want to tie up my MacBook Pro because this is an operation that could take a while. And I brought it over to my Mini. And then when I installed Parallels, it was like, oh, I see a drive image here. By the way, I should probably generate a new MAC address for the network interface because you're on a different machine, right? And I'm like, oh, cool. So hats off to Parallels. And the other thing that Parallels does is when you plug it in, or pretty much any USB device, most of the VMs do this, but Parallels did it fine. It's like, hey, I see a device here on USB. Do you want me to give it to the Mac or the PC? And I'm like, give it to the PC. So once I ran the WinMFS utility, and you can read about this, but I'll go, a high level. But basically it says, all right, here's your options. And actually, I did the just OS backup option. So you can do two things. You can either backup the entire OS, and I would recommend to anybody, including you, Dave, who runs any sort of TiVo, make a backup.
Start over with a new drive down the road if my drive crashes, when my drive crashes. Yeah, that's really important. Yeah, hang on. For TiVo users, if your drive dies, your TiVo is still usable if you put another drive in there with TiVo, with the right TiVo OS on there. The problem is you can't get a drive with TiVo OS on it easily. Right. In fact,
will not sell it to you.
There's one place called Weak Knees that will sell you TiVo drives, and they've got a nice little business doing that. But John's advice is copy just the OS and save it on a disk image, and put it on your NAS drive or on some backup drive somewhere, and just save it there. And then if your drive dies, get a new blank drive and use this WinMFS utility to copy your old OS onto this one, and at least then you're back up and running. But the OS, you copied only the OS, John, right? Not your TV shows. So you started from scratch.
The thing is, you can do that, but the thing is, right, the amount of time it would take, probably because of USB 2 and all that. I mean, when it estimated it, it was like, yeah, it's going to take about 5 hours. And the thing is, I'm thinking,
it's not bad.
Is the stuff I have, but to me, the thing is, the stuff I had stored on it really wasn't that important. I mean, it was, old copies of old shows that have stopped, and I'm like, whatever. I'm just going to start from scratch. So the thing is, looking here, Dave, so I have a file here, TiVoSeries3.tbk, and it's about 300 megs.
Okay,
so if anything, for TiVo owners, use this utility. If anything else, I would say this is critical. If you want your TiVo to survive past when your hard drive will die, and it will die,
right?
It's just when. Making this backup file makes it trivial for you to then restore just the OS, and pretty much you're in a state where you got a freshly initialized TiVo. That's basically what I did. So I, went from a 250 to a 500 gig drive, and my selection process was pretty much, I looked at the similar I got from B&H. Actually, the most aggravating part was, so B&H is in Brooklyn. They're a really good place. That I bought my Mini from them and all that. But Dave, here was the bizarre part. So they shipped it from Brooklyn, New York to Allentown, Pennsylvania,
uh-huh,
to some city in Massachusetts, and then to me. Because you chose cheap shipping. Well, I chose Super Saver, but it's like, dude, this was like shipped like to every state except, I'm close to Brooklyn.
Right.
It's like I could drive to this place and pick it up, whereas they stretch this out to three or four days.
You chose Super Saver.
I'm wondering who's saving in that.
they had to take the gas to drive it from Brooklyn, New York, right, to Pennsylvania, to Massachusetts, to Connecticut. I'm like, couldn't you have just gone from like New York to Connecticut?
Yeah, but they didn't have a truck doing that. So.
Right. So so basically, once I installed the new drive, everything was great. And it, basically, if you go to the info screen, it said, all right, instead of 35 hours HD capability, you now have 70. So
that's awesome.
But no, it made me happy. And again, for any TiVo owners, no matter what drive you have in your TiVo, it's going to die. So you got to think about it.
Yeah. But just like, I mean, it's a computer just like anything else, you know, it's, and yeah, it's going to die someday.
Oh my gosh. Have we been here an hour, Dave? Well,
yeah. Yeah. We're pushing the limits, man.
Well, we've got the questions next time, but
yeah. Yeah, it's good. We'll be back on, I can't see the calendar right
Monday?
Now. Sunday, Monday, something like that. Yeah, yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, we'll put it out there for you. So, yes, if you want to send in questions, send them to feedback@macgeekgab.com. Right, John?
I think I heard you, Dave. I believe you said, though, you know, I could be wrong, but I believe you said feedback@macgeekgab.com.
I said feedback@macgeekgab.com. You can send us email there. You can send us screenshots, audio comments, links, whatever you like. Crash logs, even. That seems to be a popular attachment that we get these days. And we're happy to help you pour through those. You can call us at 206-666-GEEK, which, John, is
4335. Yes. But hey, there's more. If you want to contact us on the Twitters, the publication or the podcast is Mac Geek Gab. I am John Efron. He is Dave Hamilton. The other guy is Pilot Pete. And the publication is Mac Observer. All in first.
Yeah. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/MacGeekGab. You can also find us at Google Plus. We will put a link to that in the show notes too, because it's a big, long, ugly URL. And when we are streaming, and we will post to those two places, Google Plus and Facebook, we will post events there. So you can see when the next stream is happening if you're interested. And then you follow us at macgeekgab.com/stream. And John, I think that does it. And we can start moving our way out of here. Before we do, though, I want to thank Michael Johnston from the We Have Communicators podcast and getapplure.com for converting this show to AAC for us and for you. Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com, provides the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. Of course, you heard about gazelle.com to sell all your stuff. Also, BB Edit from Bare Bones Software, Text Expander and PDF Pen from Smile Software, at smilesoftware.com. And of course, Squarespace for your easy hosting and more. I'll be back with media. Well, John, I have to travel home tomorrow. I'm on a 6 a.m. flight home. So do you have any advice for me before I do?
Just avoid the TSA. Otherwise, you may get caught. Made up.